And kill one.
Look like you're about to go on a sailboat.
He does.
Wearing shoes without socks.
Yeah. And like chino shorts. And he can't even defend himself.
Wife's wearing one of his button-up shirts, but unbuttoned, yeah. Billowing in the wind.
Yeah.
Joke's on you guys. This is my wife's sweater. Do you have wives? Sorry, it's been a while, a couple weeks. I was moving countries, which is a lot of work, basically. Mm-hmm. So didn't have internet, didn't even have power, you know, didn't even have an apartment for a while, but have all those things now. And
how's the new place feeling?
It's great.
Do you want to say where you are, or is it?
Yeah, I live in Manhattan, Chinatown. I live in Chinatown.
Nice. How's really that?
Cool. It's so cool. Yeah.
The city that never stops eating apples.
Yeah. The apple that never sleeps.
Yeah.
It's cool. I have a view of the Freedom Tower out my living room window.
Nice. Do you contemplate the lives lost and international order and the war on terror?
I do. I think about what a spectator seat it would have been.
Oh yeah, great view.
I went to Ground Zero last week, basically, you know, for a laugh. And I'd say it wasn't very funny. It was a pretty somber atmosphere.
Okay.
And a pretty, you know, the monument there is beautiful. You really feel you feel the weight of it. So,
not you what take I back everything
for.
You said.
Yeah. Maybe 9/11 isn't as funny as I thought it was.
You moved to New York and suddenly you're like, yeah, what we went through in 9/11 was everyone really came together.
Yeah.
As a New Yorker.
Someone tried to give me that when I moved here, like kind of initially in 2021. Someone that I know here was like, yeah, during the pandemic, it was pretty amazing to see New Yorkers coming together and like really caring about each other. And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure people do that like everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
Basic human emotion. Care about others. What's new with you, Michael?
Same old, mate. Plodding along. It's hot. That's about as much as I got to say about the weather. That's my weather update, I suppose.
Nice.
We do need a weather update.
Mm.
Yeah.
Stinking hot. Many a fly.
That sounds nice. It's not the flies, but the heat. Actually doesn't sound nice.
Not that anyone asked, but I'm doing okay too.
I was about to ask.
It's fine. But I also have no updates. If I think about it, there was like a list of things I was going to bring up. Oh, we could do a for our ongoing Beatles segment.
Yep.
On Zizek and so on. Oh, by the way, welcome to Zizek and so on. I'm Peter. We got Will and Michael as well.
Mm-hmm.
What do we think of the last Beatles song?
I liked it.
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Overdo it. Didn't try to make it the greatest song of all time.
Yeah, it was classy.
Yeah.
Again, further proof that Paul McCartney is the best human being in history.
We do love P-Mac. It's not cool to be the guy that loves George Harrison the most.
I actually still feel like it kind of is. Well, like, but amongst all the musicians I know prefer Paul, but I think generally people like to say George. It's especially fashionable these days to hate John.
Mm-mm-mm.
Do you think basically it's because obviously there's like the loner kind of sad guy image that George has.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think it's because he's like basically just the hottest one?
It could be. Though, like, looking back at old videos of them when they were young, compared to like other British Invasion bands, besides Mick Jagger, basically all the British Invasion guys like weren't very handsome.
No, they were totally weirdos.
Yeah.
Like, weird looking.
Are we pretending that Paul McCartney isn't super handsome?
I think he's quite handsome.
Yeah. He is, I mean, he is, but it's like he doesn't have the lines of George's face, you know?
It's true, but like, actually, Michael, you got a bit of a Paul McCartney Let It Be era thing going right now.
You do.
You do. Microphone in front of your face.
Mike, Michael's like, are you sure he's not really handsome?
When I find myself. This is the exact angle that the Let It Be music video.
Yeah, I feel like you're about to tell me about Mother Mary. Then the Get Back documentary, you see the narrative that we have of like the Beatles, of like who represents what, like kind of completely undermined. And you see, I think George comes off the worst because he's just being like a moody little bitch in the background. And people give flack to John about inviting his actual girlfriend, who like in the video you see Paul being like, yeah, no worries, you can bring her. And then instead, George brings by a bunch of fucking Hare Krishnas who are like the most annoying people in the world.
I got some free food from a Hare Krishna last week.
How was it?
It was fine.
It's like, how were the curry. Sweet potatoes?
Chippy curry and some like gross looking sweet mush.
Uh-huh.
I was like, what's that? He was like, it's sweet, you'll like it. And I was like, I'm not touching that, buddy.
Classic Hare Krishna fair.
What are those books like? They always have the Bhagavad Gita, right?
Mm. Yeah, the third George Harrison on the cover.
Yeah.
It's called Chant and Be Happy. It's like one of the main ones.
Right.
Put George Harrison on it.
George Harrison quote, I have become death, destroyer of worlds.
Destroyer of the Beatles. I guess we should.
You can talk about how much you loved I forgot what it's called. The Scorsese film.
Oh, well, I actually don't have a long... yeah, it's good. I will say, and obviously, it's a little long. But generally, I thought it was pretty good. Michael did not like it.
Nah.
What was it, Michael?
I thought it was a confused mess.
I would say... Yeah, I agree with that. The first hour is a little... beside the plot, like it's not really necessary to the plot. And then there's like a moment where the light turns on and the plot starts. You're like, oh, this is where the movie begins. And then it's really good, but there's some weird...
Should I skip the first hour of the movie when I go to see it?
You could. Basically, all you need to know is that Leo Dio meets girl, falls in love with girl. But if you're gonna miss the first hour, it's a bit of a loss, because the first 10 minutes is really good.
I'll see the whole thing, but there's a somewhere in the surrounding blocks there's a jackhammering, and then in the downstairs apartment there's some kind of construction grinding occurring, and then across the street someone's hammering. So please talk. Please clap. Okay, we read an Alenka Zupančič essay today from Problemy, 2017. It's called Lying on the Couch.
Which is like it's a pun, there, yeah.
Yeah. Lying and lying. And she's talking about psychoanalysis.
Yeah. Michael, do you have any notes on what Problemy is?
It was founded in 1962. Yeah, go on. You can do it.
Yeah. I mean, this is just my memory. It was something basically that Žižek et al. Like took over in sometime in the 70s.
Yeah.
Is it a Slovenian magazine?
Yeah.
You're Yugoslavian?
Yeah. It took off in the early 80s with the Society for Theoretical Psychoanalysis, established in Ljubljana. Yeah.
Okay.
Problemy. Anyway, yeah. Lying on the couch, laying on the couch, Alenka Zupančič begins by writing, in what way can a conceptual framework of psychoanalysis help us understand the intimate link between culture and lying? More specifically, what can it say about certain modes of lying as constitutive of culture? Or put another way, all Cretans are liars. I'm a Cretan. Discuss. All liars are mortal. Will is immortal. Will is a liar.
Mm.
But she's basically trying to draw, you know, discuss what the dynamics are of truth and lying in the way we react within culture.
Mm-hmm.
How they're formulated and acted upon, and how both truth and a lie can be kind of their opposite, but
yeah,
truth is more primary.
She calls it there's an unsymmetrical relation between lying and truth.
There's a kind of phenomenology of lying, mm-hmm. the way that we kind of experience it and act on it. But I guess that a kind of consideration of lying is more so a consideration of what truth is.
Yeah. Yeah. And this has to do with like, it's how we actually use language on the level of enunciated content,
mm-hmm.
or on the level of the speaker of the enunciated subject. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like this, there's an action here. This is not just like a rumination on capital T truth, right? Nor is it just a skeptical, like, what is truth even,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Yeah. Yep.
How is truth mobilized? How is truth mobilized in the form of a lie? Lie not being just the opposite of truth. There's something.
Yeah.
At work. There's a working of truth in certain lies, certain ways of lying.
Yeah. That like this kind of non-symmetrical notion of truth and lies means that it's not just like a lie isn't just the opposite of the truth. When that is the case, it's like surely a part of lying, but it's not like the crucial component of what a lie is.
Mm-hmm.
He uses Jacqueline Miller, a bit of a quote here, but
yep.
She says, there is no doubt a truth, which is but the opposite of falsehood. But there is another which stands over or grounds both of them, and which is related to the very fact of formulating. For I can say nothing without positing it as true. And even if I say I am lying, I am saying nothing but it is true that I am lying, which is why truth is not the opposite of falsehood. Or again, we could say that there are two truths, one that is the opposite of falsehood, and another that bears up both the true and the false indifferently.
It's the most coherent excerpt I've ever heard from Miller.
I was about to say, it's a little convoluted. Although nicely written. I'll give him that.
Usually when I read a quote from him, I do not know what he's talking about. But there I think that is
largely the point.
Yeah.
Alenka says, in other words, a dimension of truth is an indispensable background of lying, whereas vice versa is not the case. I don't know if Žižek would agree with that, I have to say. Like, for instance, he says that these probably aren't symmetrical things, but he says that crime forms the background of law.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, the founding of law, mm-hmm. or of a body of or a code of laws is a crime in the way that it breaks into the kind of natural order and creates another dimension, sets the bounds of another dimension.
Yeah, a new symbolic order.
Those probably aren't the same things, but I think this is probably
also not the same thing. Sorry, Michael, go ahead.
No, you're right. Go for it. Yeah.
Oh, well, like just what comes to mind with like another kind of Lacanian formulation of truth as a structure of fiction, like to a certain extent, you can say like truth has a structure of a lie, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I would just say that fiction exists in the order of truth, not in the order of lying, mm-hmm. I would say.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But nonetheless points to a more complicated relationship than merely calling truth the opposite of a lie.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the Cretan example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the idea that truth itself speaks, right? Like
mm-hmm.
that Miller bit, that Lacanian aphorism, which basically is, you know, there is no meta language. is pointing to the fact that there's no outside of language from which you could articulate that outsideness in any meaningful way, right? Like, mm-hmm. yeah, but like, I think the key part is that, or the more important part is that it produces this excess, this surplus where the mm-hmm. truth itself speaks. So it's not as much that you speak as that you're spoken. So the very transcendental background of being able to make meaning at all is the thing that also speaks.
I, the truth, am speaking. This is the second truth on which depend the kind of like the true and the falsehood, which are kind of like the opposed, you know, opposites of each other.
Mm.
There's a kind of like other truth. Yeah.
Right. It's the very background in which a truth statement can even be formulated.
Mm. How is that different from like a notion of grammar, like a like the structures within language that make meaning comprehensible? Mm.
I'd say it'd be like the, well, part of it at least is like the non-intended meanings like that are generated. Mm. That's the surplus, excessive part of it.
Yeah, because as opposed to what we were mentioning in the last episode about what Wittgenstein is saying, about language being essentially something that is used, she says language is not just something that's used. And like you just said, there's the unspoken elements of language. Or rather, there's the unintended aspects of mm-hmm. spoken language, things that are clearly what is meant in a certain yeah. statement, but is not said.
Right.
But both participants know what is meant beyond exactly. what is being said. We could refer to Derrida's book of grammatology. Sorry, I was a bit late for that pun, but I thought of it while you were talking.
Nice one.
I think a good example is that Guernica, Colin Powell one that we bring up all the time, but like how it was like in 2003 when Colin Powell was addressing the UN Assembly in order to advocate the attack on Iraq, where Guernica was the background, like the painting in the background of the press shot.
That's crazy. That is fucking insane. I forgot about that.
And obviously like the concern is that it would give rise to the wrong kind of associations, like advocating the bombing of Iraq by a far superior US Air Force. But the point is that if they hadn't removed or hadn't covered up Guernica, probably no one would have noticed or associated the speech with the painting. Mm-hmm. But by removing it, that gesture, like concealing the painting,
they knew, draws attention yeah, they to knew it. The meaning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the same thing happened recently with the Australian Prime Minister went to the White House to visit Biden and the B-52s were supposed to play and they were called off in deference to the victims of the Israel-Hamas war. So it functions insane. The same way.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Like the act of not mentioning or concealing something creates the additional meaning.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's especially interesting that what Colin Powell was doing was concocting the or delivering the absolute and utter lie about weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah,
the evidence for which was that they couldn't find them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that the supposed chemical weapons were from a movie, like from The Rock.
Yeah, that was one of yeah
yeah like one of the descriptors. Yeah, the Rock. Yeah, that lobster.
Nice one. Nice B-52s one. Very nice one. So the lobster, Jordan Peterson, David Foster Wallace. Okay, so she says, yeah, this is what we're getting at here. There's the, once again, she says, the double dimension of lying is not symmetrical to that of the truth. A lie, as different from falsehood, is nothing but the effect of truth that a falsehood can produce on the level of speech. That is, on the level of its formulation. That's what we were just trying to say. And she has this example here. She says, if I'm giving a talk or a lecture, and at the end of the lecture, I ask someone that I don't really know what they thought of it, and it's clear that they didn't think much of it, they didn't think it was worth the paper it was written on, all they have to say to deliver that truth is, I found it interesting. Mm. She would interpret that as, I didn't care for it. And this was the same when Peter and I played when we used to play some shows. It was a running joke in the little in community band. That we're in our band, but I think other people knew about it too.
Yeah.
That if we saw a band that we didn't like, we would, if we were playing after them, there's the obligation to say something to them. But what do you say if you hated it? We decided to say tight set.
Yeah. We're always like, hey man, tight set. And it was
which is
like one of us would overhear and we'd all kind of like laugh in the background because we were just telling them.
But one time
that sucked.
But one time we played a set and at the end of it, a guy that I vaguely knew said to me, tight set. And I appreciated the comment. It was complimentary enough. And then when I was walking away, I was like, wait a second. Was that an insult? Either way, it was true, you know, like
it was a fucking tight set. It's both. you like convince yourself, like from whatever standpoint you are, like it means totally opposite things.
But what does she say? She puts it well when she's talking about that.
Was dependent on the formulation of lying with the truth or telling the truth with a lie.
Yeah.
So in that case, we were lying with. Oh wait, no, telling the truth with means of a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the differences between a polite truth and telling, like, a blatant truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, like, the idea with a polite lie would be that you save face, but you don't take responsibility in the same way that it's, like, not the same ethical position as telling a blatant truth because you have to include the fact that it's capable of hurting them.
Yeah, it's like the Kramer position in Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Kramer will tell the blatant truth.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking it's the difference between, you know, like that, was it A Few Good Men, like the you can't handle the truth. So like the two variations would be like you can't handle the inherent impossibility of the truth or it's you can't handle the truth at the level of enunciation.
Very nice.
You can't handle the truth at the level of enunciation.
It all comes back to Tom Cruise.
You know, like that's the idea, right? Like it's the same with facts. Like facts themselves aren't, like in a way, they're not neutral, right? Until they get they get mobilized and caught within a symbolic frame. And that's what produces that excess or surplus of meaning.
It's like, I mean, maybe we don't have to talk about it, but it's like, who really bombed the hospital in the Gaza Strip? Like the kind of obsession with the details of like the true perpetrator of that crime completely obfuscates the actual
horror
of what's going on.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Knowledge is a fetish again. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to confront the trauma of that, of the real there. I've got an example of lying in the guise of truth that Zizek was writing about. So he's talking about, factual truth, subjective lies, yada yada. They're saying the answer is clear. The obligation is not to lie or to falsify or ignore facts on behalf of some higher political truth, but, and this is a much more difficult thing to do, it's to change one's subjective position so that telling the factual truth will not involve the lie of the subjective position of enunciation.
Well, okay, let's work through that.
Yeah, like basically, we'll have to decide how to include this. Therein resides the limitation of standard political correctness. Instead of changing the subjective position from which we speak, it imposes on us a set of rules with regard to content. But all these rules on content effectively leave our subjective position untouched.
Huh. Wow. Yeah.
Fuck, man.
So that's like the two versions of the Guernica, right? Like, do you keep the painting in the background or do you cover it?
Either one alludes to this other dimension of truth that she's describing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I live very close. I can see, in fact, from my window, the most criminal place in the world, the highest rate of crimes in the world, which is the financial district of Manhattan. But it could never be expressed, you know, in those terms. Because to do so, you have to identify the objective violence of the economic system itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
But that's not what we think of as violence, which is only subjective violence, right? Generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we already have that distinction, right? Like white collar crime or white collar criminals.
Yeah, but like those. Uh-huh. Everyone is like, oh, what's wrong with a white collar? It sounds like a nice collar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to a nice present. Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, it's also like there's so much enjoyment wrapped around it. You know, like when Trump would talk about having not paid his taxes, he gets championed for working the system. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's people don't, it's like not sticking exactly to the right speed limit. It's one of those types of regulations which people enjoy transgressing. Like if you stick to the letter of the law, then if you don't undermine the law, then you're not one of us.
Very nice. And yet there is this system of a code of a proper action that doesn't directly correlate with the stated law. And this can relate with like the truth, right? Like in the way that we have these kind of polite lies that are kind of depend on the symbolic order, politeness kind of is a code of action that is never overtly stated. In the same way that we might break those laws because we're kind of
like,
encouraged to.
It's like offshoring your money. Like you offshore the truth to this little pleasantry.
Mm-hmm.
That's.
I like that idea though. Like formally it would be the same as the type of deferral that goes on with the subject supposed to believe. So, you know, like obviously this is a key idea for lying and telling the truth, that there's somebody who knows, so subject supposed to know, and then a subject supposed to believe, and then you have like a subject supposed to deceive, which would be part of a more conspiratorial thinking. But that idea that you're always delegating or deferring the immediacy of your engagement.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain to me again, to us, Michael, the what you were telling me yesterday about?
No, I think we should do an episode on rumor and gossip. Okay.
So back to what she's saying, and this is very important. She says, truth is more fundamental than the lie in the sense that we were just talking about. But she also says that it's problematic in itself, haunted by an inherent impossibility.
Mm.
And she says, Lacan formulates this impossibility with his famous statement that truth is not whole or not all.
Yeah.
What makes the truth not whole is the fact that it is simultaneously a constitutive dimension of speech as such and something within speech.
Because it always says more than what's intended. So that's why it can't ever be whole. So just to use like a really trite example, say we wanted to know everything about a certain topic. And let's say we could exhaust all information about it to explain it. That's not the issue. It's that every time that we attempt to, we always produce this surplus that isn't present in that moment. It's nice. Always it's like, generative.
That's well said. That's like the Borges short story that Foucault and Zizek love about the dogs. I'll bring it up.
Yeah, I think the key idea to wrap your head around is that the very form of language itself speaks, it says something, it has an effect. You know, like we talk about like a frame for a painting. So like form itself has a function and continues to generate, produce meaning. What makes the truth split, as in not whole, is that it's simultaneously a constitutive dimension of speech as such and something within speech itself.
Yeah.
That's what makes it impossible to differentiate those two levels on which truth operates and treat them separately.
And why it is not merely the opposite of lying.
Yes.
Because a lie is not the foundation of speech.
Yeah.
It's the speech dimension. Yeah.
I did find a funny new Zizek joke from the new book, The Too Late to Awaken. So he has this anecdote. I'll try and make it brief because it's like 20 sentences, but basically a wife asks a husband to go to the shop to buy her a pack of cigarettes, and it's late in the evening, the shop's closed, and the husband goes to a bar instead, and he strikes up a flirtatious conversation with a voluptuous young woman behind the bar, and they end up going home to her apartment. And after a couple of hours of passionate lovemaking, he begins to worry now how he's going to explain his long absence to his wife. He gets an idea. He asks the woman if she has any baby powder, and he rubs it into his hands. And when he arrives home, his wife is furiously awaiting for him and asks where he's been. And he replies, "The shop had already closed, so I went to a nearby bar to get the cigarettes. I began flirting with a voluptuous young woman who was serving at the bar, and we ended up in bed in her apartment. And after a couple of hours of passionate lovemaking, I finally returned home." You dirty liar, interrupts the wife. You think I didn't notice the powder on your hands? You did what you've been wanting to do for ages, even though I'd prohibited it. You went out for a late night bowling session with your friends.
So yeah, lying with the truth. Yeah. That's so great. Zizek
says, this is how ideology functions today. Ideology tells the truth, but creates conditions which guarantee that the truth itself will be perceived as a lie.
I thought the punchline was going to be that he's having sex with her and they're done. And then he asks her if she has any cigarettes. So he could say that he asked around and he found no cigarettes.
Sorry, I shouldn't applaud.
But it, his ending is better.
No, I liked your one better. Much cleaner.
She says, say the truth is not whole does not imply that a statement cannot say all there is to say, that there is always something still lacking. It's the opposite. By saying the truth, we say more than the truth. What gets in the way of the possibility of saying the whole truth is not a lack, but an excess, surplus, which is that Borges thing that I was trying to find. I did find. It says, this is Borges's taxonomy of a certain Chinese encyclopedia, which is fictional, in whose distant pages it is written that the animals are divided into A, those that belong to the emperor, B, embalmed ones, C, those that are trained, D, suckling pigs, E, mermaids, F, fabulous ones, G, stray dogs, H, those that are included in this classification, and then it goes on. And I think what Zizek has said about that is like within the that very, you know, disparate, strange list of types of animals are ones within the list. So there's like the already listed ones. And the impossibility of listing all of them, the surplus produced by the list are also part of the animals.
It's like I have three brothers, blah, 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 and me.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's what she's mentioning about the like position of enunciation, right? Yeah. Like that's also the dimension of truth. So I think that's the excess to what she's pointing to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw a Reddit post where somebody said this sounds like a 12 bong profundity, but Lacan's he references that statement, I am lying, right? So it's like, is the subject lying or is he telling the truth? And Lacan's answer is that he's telling the truth via the lie, right? So at the level of the subject of the statement, he is lying, and at the level of the subject of the enunciation, he's telling the truth about that lie.
I made a guy an espresso that I knew to be quite a bad espresso because I hadn't done the proper, you know, process of making it a good one because I was lazy. And he was drinking it, clearly not enjoying it, not finishing it. And I said to him, how's the espresso? You can be honest. And he was like, it's good. And I, of course, he was telling me that it was bad.
Yeah.
Right.
I watched that episode of Always Sunny.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah. This is an Always Sunny episode that Michael thought went along with this essay.
Okay.
The Game Gets Analyzed, season 8, episode 5.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
Dude, it's pretty funny.
It's very funny. Check it out. Maybe I wasn't paying attention, but you said the line from What's His Face about Mac is that he's always, what did you say? You said something about like,
sucking he always on thinks, pins.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm.
Yeah. That is what he says. Okay.
And then Mac picks up a pen and he's like,
and this, a well-placed pen can have quite an effect on a man like him. This must have given him quite the thrill. I bet he tried to suck on this, did he? Huh? It's okay, Doc. You can tell me. He's always sucking on the pens in our apartment. I'm always having to hide them.
So stupid.
And when Dennis sees the pen, he goes, interesting.
Yeah, a well-placed pen. This would get a man like Mac. Let me guess, he sucked on it?
He's always sucking on pens. He's always sucking on it. Just seeing, I mean, like, seeing the way that each of them responds to being not even analyzed, but being in the position
of being analyzed, like the way that they respond to the prospect of being analyzed.
Right. They're so like it's kind of, there's like some lying with the truth in there.
With D, that's a good example. Like D's the one that's going into analysis, and the whole time she's lying about being a famous actress and always has excuses for why she can't have certain roles. Like she had a schedule conflict, so she couldn't be in The Notebook. And obviously the analyst is aware and is trying to like bring her to the point where she's honest. And the analyst calls her out on lying, and D's like, no, I was acting. And then, but then the analyst is like, no, that's when you're lying. And she's like, no, that bit was acting. The rest of it was not lying. Yeah, very good. All right, anyway.
There's this girl I work with who I've only worked with a couple times. And last time we were together, she said, she mentioned her therapist. And she was like, are you in therapy? And I was like, no. And she was like, really? Is that even possible? Like, who's not in therapy?
Yeah, right.
Normal to not be in therapy. I told her, you know what my therapy is? It's drinking with the boys on the weekend.
Yeah, that's all man needs. That and quiet contemplation.
hand on knee.
Sorry. Preferably on the toilet.
Well, I think we can leave it there, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely, dude.
Yeah, nice talking to you guys.
Yep.
Talk soon.
Bye-bye.
And so on.